Hello, this is Sharon Steitler, the bird chick, and I am here with non-birding Bill.
Hello.
And it is our goal to podcast and talk about birds in a reasonably scheduled manner.
If you say so.
It is. It's going to get harder and harder, though, because I'll admit...
It's spring.
It's spring. I'm a bit stressed. Mm-hmm. I'm producing a web series, which I'm really excited about. It's
Birders
good stress.
Gone wild.
No.
Sometimes they stay up until 10 o'clock.
Birders stay up way later than that. Yeah. No, I mean, it's... I think we've discussed before, and I think I can safely say this amount. I filmed a reality show pilot last year. Mm-hmm. That... Well, it wasn't exactly Honey Boo Boo, but, you know, it was just something in the middle of this, like, well, I could do this.
Right.
And so, anyway, I got a group of sponsors together, and so we're producing a web series, and you should watch this, because there's actually scripted stuff in there. I'm not saying this is a reality show. Mm-hmm. There's some funny sketches in there. They're, like, actual people who've been on TV in at least one episode, maybe two.
So it's like The Monkees.
It's if only it was The Monkees.
You travel around solving mysteries, and then you sing a song.
No. Basically, what I was, I thought, I want to work with people I like, and I want to travel to places I like, and I want to, you know, find a way to talk to people about birds in a fun way.
That's essentially what The Monkees did, except a lot less bird talk.
Yeah, no bird talk with The Monkees. But anyway, so, you know, and so in the web series, it's I'm having fun working on it, but I'm also realizing... It premieres on YouTube on May 8th. Mm-hmm. I really need to buckle down on a few things and try and get some loose ends tied up. Mm-hmm. And then in the middle of all this, I'm also doing the Great Texas Birding Classic, which is a fun fundraiser. We're doing it by bike. And I'm kind of freaked out about that because winter lasted a long time. Mm-hmm. And I'm not up to biking.
Okay.
Like I would be at the end of the summer. And I think it's a 50-mile route that we're supposed to do. So, you know, I'm
a
lot of stress.
And all of this was put upon you. You didn't volunteer for all
I'm
of
trying
this
to
stuff.
Remind myself today. I had to go out and get some peregrine falcon footage that I needed for the web series today. And so, you know, I got up this morning and I'm driving and I'm just kind of going through my head of all the things I need to do today. And I'm feeling stressed out. And then I thought, wait a minute. Your job right now is to go to where you know peregrine falcons are and get video footage of them and stay there until you see peregrines and get reasonable footage of them. And I was just like, this is good stress to have. So, but it's still stress. And anyway, please watch the web series. It's going to be a lot of fun. The web series, I tried to make it like a game show. So the birds in each episode are a clue.
Okay.
And Clay and I have filmed all the birds ourselves through digiscoping. Mm-hmm. And so we're putting in really fun video stuff. Like there's footage in there of Clay. He had a ruby-throated hummingbird show up one day that had a satellite transmitter on it. So, I mean, there's fun and interesting bird stuff in there. But the birds in each episode are a clue. The series has a theme. And you have to figure out what the theme is. And we last night I figured out a really fun red herring, which you helped me figure out, which I'm so excited about because that makes writing the last two episodes 10 times easier.
Okay.
So anyway, it's going to be fun. It's going to be a lot of fun. And if you guess everything and you send me what you think the series theme is, you're entered into a drawing for a Swarovski spotting scope. We're also going to have other things. We're going to be giving away bird's eye apps. They're one of the sponsors of the show. Princeton University Press is a sponsor of the show, so I think we're going to get some fun prizes out of them. It's really, really exciting. And I also learned that for all the people who've been complaining that they want a Shazam app for bird watching, Princeton University Press is working on one, which I learned through this process. So that's all really exciting. And so I'm working on really fun stuff, and I can't wait for everybody to watch this. It's going to be a lot of fun. And each episode is only like 5 to 10 minutes long. They're never long. I don't think one's going to be longer than 8 minutes. I'm just throwing 10 minutes out there because I'm worried one of the episodes when I finally get it finished edited, it's going to be 10 minutes. But these are going to be things you could watch on a break on your computer at work. Mm-hmm. And you'll maybe learn a bird tip, a photography tip. You'll see some cool stuff. So if you've noticed, I've not been writing at all on my blog and I've just been keeping to social media and Twitter. It's because the web series is taking up a lot of my time, but I'm really excited about it.
All right. So what do we have to talk about tonight?
Well, you know, I was looking at this to try and talk about things on the podcast, and I think just the overwhelming theme right now, I don't know. Well, it's bird bird photography. And I think this started off with me this week because there is an amendment that has been introduced to the Minnesota legislature that is going to make it a petty misdemeanor to lure in owls for photography. And it's really fascinating because I don't know if you know about it this winter. There have been a lot of snowy owls that have shown up this winter.
I think we've mentioned it once or twice, yes.
Did you actually go out with me to see any of these snowy owls?
I think we went to the airport.
One. You saw that one
We went out to the airport once, but no, I didn't go out with you on many of your
But tracks. You did actually see one.
Yes, I saw one very far away.
Yeah.
But
I've seen snowy owls. It was actually really quite close. I just didn't have any binoculars or anything. I was just like, oh, see that equipment? That's a snowy owl.
No, I saw it, yeah.
Yeah, you totally saw one.
Saw it.
You could not... You had to try really hard not to see a snowy owl in... quite a bit of the eastern United States this winter because they were everywhere. Because I saw quite a few, and some of them I chased. Some of them was like, oh, hey, that's just a snowy owl right there. Crazy. But as what happens with owls, people get a little nuts. And you get people that are just like, hey, I heard this photographer, like, gets...
We've talked about
baiting
was a huge issue.
It was a crazy issue, and it was a bigger issue than it's ever been. And it got crazy because you already had a group of people who take pictures of owls that have been baiting and teaching other people about it. And so other people are trying it who don't know that much about birds. Then you have young kids who are just like, wouldn't it be cool if we put a mouse in front of a GoPro camera? And so then you have snowy owls flying into GoPro cameras. Apparently there was one guy who was even putting live mice in an aquarium without the water and putting that out there so the owl could see the mouse but would fly into the aquarium. But he was trying to economize by not losing the mouse every time the owl
I would think
came
the owl will be able to detect the glass.
You know, I haven't heard. I just noticed in the bill wording that they were talking specifically about that incident because I thought, you know, when we banned birds and we use live prey, the birds see the nets at the last second and sometimes dodge it.
Right.
Anyway, so a bill has been introduced and, you know, everyone's like, yeah, we're not on board with this. But because people also do the thing of taking plastic mice and attaching them to fishing poles and whipping them out. They're also saying you can't use any kind of pretty much inanimate object to lure in an owl. Okay. And at first you look at this and you're like, okay, that makes sense. But then it's like, whoa, wait a minute. What about birding trips that you go on where at night they do owl calls to call in the owls?
Right.
That kind of falls into that category. And then someone from the American Birding Association pointed out and said, you know, wait, the way this is worded technically, you know, since you can't even use inanimate objects and you can't, quote, lure in owls, putting up an owl box is technically considered luring.
I suppose that would be a stretch of the...
So there's still
that's a bit of a stretch. Yeah,
they're still playing around with the wording. It's really fascinating because the guy that introduced the bill was even saying we might even change it so that it says that you can't do this next to roads, but you can do this maybe on some private property.
Now, this is in Minnesota, right?
This is only in Minnesota,
right? Well, I mean, Minnesota is, and I don't know, you know, if there's a group behind this, or I mean, we're sort of one of the states in the forefront of this because, as I think I mentioned, like 10 podcasts ago, like, if you're building a structure, like a big structure in Minnesota, you have to do part of your environmental impact structure report has to be how will this affect birds.
Well, that's, like yeah, that's, birds. That's, yeah,
so I have to imagine
that.
That this is, you know, part of that same.
It is, but it's interesting that it's specifically to owls and the way this is worded. Mm-hmm. And they're also saying you can't use inanimate objects. So that,
I mean, people bait other raptors as well.
Yeah, well, I went to Texas. I went to that photography ranch where it's private property. Yeah. It's far away from any major highway, period. And we went out, put out about 20 pounds of taxidermy leftovers and...
taxidermied leftovers?
It was like the meat that didn't have anything in it.
Oh,
so
okay.
It's like, you know, right. they only use the skin.
Sure, okay.
So it's like, here's that. And some roadkill and some chicken parts that I even paid for to bait in... caracaras, and we also got in some Harris hawks and some turkey vultures and black vultures.
That's interesting. I'm interested in who sponsored this legislation specifically for owls, because presumably we won't have another eruption next year.
No, but people have been baiting owls, period. It is something that happens in the wintertime. And I have mixed feelings on it. I feel like there aren't really studies on it, but at the same time, I'm not a big fan of people baiting owls to major highways.
That creates problems.
But I do definitely see the gray area that you get into of why for me to do this for other birds, but not snowy owls. It gets into the issue of enforcement owls.
Because it's a petty misdemeanor, which means, I guess you could have a citizen's arrest, but a misdemeanor, a police officer has to see the person doing it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the
other thing. It's like, oh, it's just a petty misdemeanor.
Yeah, it's not really a felony. I'd hate to see somebody going to jail for more than a year for baiting an owl.
Well, sure. There are some people, I think, that would like to see that, though.
There are people who would like to see people going to jail, supermax prisons for littering. So, it's good that we have it on the books, I guess, as officially disapproving of it.
It's not officially on the books yet. Okay, it's something that they're working on. But it's interesting that it's made it this far. And it's fascinating to me because if this happens because I went to the Minnesota Facebook birding page and I was first I talked to the administrators and I said, I know this is a hot button issue. And I think it would be interesting to post to the page because the way it's worded now, it affects even you using taped calls. Sure. And I have used this as a park ranger. And I know taped calls is also one of those things where it's like, oh, won't you please think of the birds? And here's the thing I'm thinking of. I'm taking a bunch of people out at night. And this is their one chance to see an owl in a in a way that's not going to trudge in on... It's not 50 people every day staring down a great horned owl nest. Right. It's a way to, look at an owl. And I also explain to everybody the ethics of doing it and that this is why you do it this time of year. This is how you do it. This is why you don't do it all the time.
Right.
So it's a powerful tool to show a lot of people a bird with very little intrusion when done well. Mm-hmm. So, and I wanted to post it, and the administrators were really nice about the page, because they're like, thank you for letting us know before you put this up, and they said, just make sure you say that this isn't a political issue, that you just want to make birders aware that this is out there. I was like, great, thanks. It was really funny, after I posted, it was like, I'm not putting this out here to open the can of worms about baiting, but I just wanted everybody to know, because this is going to affect how some of you birdwatch if this becomes legal. And Dave LaPuma from Leica was, so I was like... Here's a can and a can opener. There might be $1 million in this can and not worms, but please don't open the can.
Filled with spring snakes that go flying out at you.
But people, for the most part, were... I just wanted people to know that this was out there, that they needed to comment on it.
It's this whole thing. I mean, I think we talked about this before. It's like I've been tracking legislation about bird feeding, and they're basically trying to keep people... They're trying to keep the pigeon population down and stop people from feeding pigeons. But the laws are vaguely written and essentially unenforceable. And if you did enforce them, suddenly you have a news story where you're taking an 80-year-old woman into court for giving breadcrumbs to pigeons. Mm-hmm. And it's, but it's again...
I'd blame Mary Poppins and her Feed the Birds song. Tuppence that bag, man.
Tuppence a bag. Okay, so...
But it's interesting. If this goes through as is, and suddenly you're not allowed to use taped calls for great horned owls.
Right.
There's like a whole big can... Or I shouldn't say great horned. If you're not allowed to use taped calls for any owl, that is just a ginormous can. And it's like, are we going to start legislating what bird calls can be played for birds? Because at the end of the day, I feel like... There are so many conservation issues out there that you need to pick your battles. And I'm not a fan of people baiting owls next to a major highway, but at the end of the day, there's bigger fish to fry.
Yeah, I'm more concerned about the private zoos issue that I think we've talked about before, people keeping big cats and stuff, than I am about people baiting owls.
Well, it's an issue. I'm just going to talk about this here. You know I've been dealing with this for a couple weeks.
Yeah.
Okay, so we have the Minnesota Epilepsy Foundation, which is celebrating their 60th anniversary.
Yep, fine group.
Fine group, and my goodness, please give money to epilepsy.
Give money to epilepsy research.
Give money to epilepsy research. Thank you for clarifying that. I've known people with epilepsy. Mm-hmm. I had a dog with epilepsy. I have actually used my CPR training with someone who was having an epileptic seizure. And so I am all for people giving money to that. God bless the Minnesota Epilepsy Foundation. They're celebrating their 60th anniversary, mm-hmm. and they decided to do that by having a fundraiser where you get a balloon, and they were going to do a 60,000 balloon release in May.
Right.
And I didn't hear about it until some of the environmental groups got hold of it, one of them including the Balloons Blow Girls, and I got copied on it on Facebook. I was like, you need to fight this! And it's like, I really don't want to be in the position to tell people not to give money to the Epilepsy Research Foundation in Minnesota. So I just sent some private emails to people that mm-hmm. I knew. It was like, hey, FYI, just I think you might be getting some heat from this. Let me help you. Let's talk about it. And the really cool thing is that through a lot of people, I think, that intervened besides myself and a lot of reasonable conversation, the Minnesota Epilepsy Foundation is not going to do this. And I really give them kudos because I felt bad mm-hmm. because they started getting vilified in social media.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And it was hard because, the thing is, and one of the things I sympathize with, because I dabble with people who don't know birds very well, mm-hmm. I think these people did their due diligence and like, yeah, we'll do a balloon release. Mm-hmm. And here's the thing. There's a lot of information out there from the Balloon Council and from the balloon people themselves that just say, oh, our balloons are biodegradable. Right. Here's research on it. And I know you're going to hear from environmental groups. Here's why these environmental groups are wrong. And then the Minnesota Epilepsy Foundation even talked to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And the Pollution Control Agency was like, yeah, whatever. Yeah, do whatever you got to do. We don't care. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, the letters started coming in to everybody from the Epilepsy Foundation to the Pollution Control. And all of a sudden, Minnesota Epilepsy Foundation is just being vilified.
Right.
And they're like, but we asked, and it's not our fault. Yep. And so I felt really bad. And I felt like that was a really big fish to fry, because it's like, okay, even if the Balloon Council is right, that most of their balloons biodegrade in air, which is not true, let's just say only 1% of your balloons affect animals. That's 600 animals.
Yeah,
that's a pretty significant number. And that got stopped. And kudos to the Minnesota Epilepsy Foundation for stopping it in the middle of their campaign to sell mm-hmm. gala tickets and fundraise. Yeah, please give money to the Minnesota Epilepsy. Give money to any epilepsy foundation that does research, but I feel like that is a bigger fish.
Not to the groups that promote epilepsy.
Yeah, I'm not down with
pro-epilepsy.
Pro-epilepsy. But I mean, I felt like
they just go out and like shine flashing lights at kids at watching anime.
So I feel, so when people
I apologize. Don't write in about that. I apologize for that joke already. It was.
I'm just ignoring it now.
Quite possibly the stupidest joke I've ever made.
I'm not married to you at all. What's your name again?
Did you ever get so married you weren't married anymore?
You stole my joke.
That's my joke. All right, let's continue.
But anyway, I get inundated with so many projects that it's just like, who do I? It's so when I look at owl baiting, it's like, I'm not thrilled that people bait owls next to highways. But at the end of the day, they're bigger fish to fry out there.
Much bigger fish to fry.
I think this is going to be a very unpopular thing to say. I think baiting and taped calls bother more birders than they do birds.
Okay. Well, I think we've mentioned before there's never been a study that conclusively spoke about how tipped calls.
Well, what's going to be fascinating about all of this is that one of the owls that has been baited the most has a satellite transmitter on it. It's one of the birds in Project Snowstorm. No, I mean, so we're going to find out if it goes back to its breeding grounds and still hunts.
All right. What else do we have?
Well, this is all kind of a larger issue mm-hmm. because when I was trying to figure out what to do for the podcast tonight, I was in the middle of reading an article that Greg Neese from the American Birding Association published.
Okay.
Or shared, I should say. He didn't publish it. But it was about the whole thing with the California condor.
Oh, God.
And the and using puppets to raise chicks. So tonight, Greg Neese linked to an article over on Aon, and it's all about birds reared by puppets and the problems with the California condors. And essentially, it's just like,
wait, the California condor has problems?
But the problems.
Whoa, back this up. Are you saying that this bird, that there's only 1.5 of them in the entire world, might have problems relating to the actual world? It's the bird that they've hooked up to cyberspace so that it can learn new skills to survive in today's marketplace.
They haven't hooked them up to cyberspace.
That's the next step.
But anyway, continue. I was reading this and I thought, anthropomorphically? I mean, the argument, too, was about how these birds have been raised by puppets and what a disaster it's been. I know. This is going to get crazy.
It's time to
write
the music. It's time to light the lights.
This is all weird.
The more tragic because I know how many millions of dollars and how many tens of thousands of hours have been poured into this by people.
No. That's essentially what this article is about. God. It's like raising birds with puppets was really more about making the rest of us feel good than it is about, because it talks about all the problems with the condors and one of the big problems.
How many condors are there in the world? How many California condors are there?
I think there's 200 and some now.
Okay.
But so the condors wouldn't leave Les Reed alone. And I remember this story, too. Mm-hmm. They went in and they ripped up his house. And so he, like, came home and he found California condors, like, had ripped open his back porch. And this wasn't just any guy. And this was the crazy thing about the article that I'm reading in Aeon, because I remember when this story came out. And it was like, oh, some poor guy who doesn't care about condors got his back porch ripped open and his bedroom ripped open by a bunch of condors. God. Can't someone just explain to him? Well, it turns out that this guy was a former member of the Sierra Club board of directors. Mm-hmm. So he came home and he found that 8 young condors had ripped open a hole in the screen of his door and were tearing apart his mattress. When he walked in on them, one of the birds even had a pair of his underwear dangling from his beak. It talks about how in the story it kind of vilified him, saying that, well, you must have clearly been putting food out for the condors and things like that. I wasn't. I fought for these birds and all this stuff. But it essentially talked about how raising birds with puppets, we kind of missed something. We worked so hard not to imprint them on humans that so it's like, oh my God, all these condors were raised by, you know, in love-starved relationships. There are millennials, and I guess we're Generation Xers ourselves.
Yes, I definitely am.
I'm on the fine line. Yeah. Emotionally unavailable parents that are essentially puppets. We can relate to that.
Okay, I need you to stick up for me on this. Look, however much of a jerk I am about people, I am a huge softy when it comes to animals.
Are you actually allowing me to... let me tell you, since you're bringing this up, I'm going to tell you. He swerves for butterflies on the highway.
I did that once, and it wasn't the highway. It was our street.
Look, it was not our street. It was like, a street.
If we're watching a movie,
60 miles an hour.
And an animal in a movie is going to be hurt, even if it's monitored by the, you know, the ASPCA and all this stuff. I love animals. If I go to a party, I'm probably going to end up talking to the cat at the party.
Yes, but you're an introvert, also.
Kind of.
Kind of. You're a total introvert.
No, I just don't like people, but. The California condor, okay, I learned a very useful term, and I can't remember where I learned this, a term called charismatic megafauna.
A lot of people know that term, sweetie.
And what it means is that there are certain animals that if you feature them, people become attached to them and will give you money, like pandas and tigers and lions. So you talk about the plight of these, or wolves.
Oh, about this in the wildlife world.
Yeah. So... I would classify the California condor as uncharismatic. And I'm...
It's got a 10-foot wingspan. That's pretty darn charismatic.
I'm sure that... And bless them. Bless the people who have poured not just their money, but their time into trying to keep this species alive. But I don't see what niche it's filling.
The problem is its niche is no longer there. Because it was in... Yeah. I can never pronounce this. Is it the Pleistocene era?
I have no idea.
That was its heyday. I mean, its heyday was when there were dead mammoths. Mm-hmm. You know, that was the kind of stuff it needed to chow down on.
Well, we're going to clone the mammoth and bring that back, so...
So we might as well... Yeah, so the condor, we just need to keep it alive long enough. But the problem is, it was probably... There have even been some arguments that said... Even before humans arrived, the condor was on the way out. And then we came and we just kind of accelerated
and
how quickly
sure
it was going to be out. I'm
sure that we have learned a lot about science and biology in the study of this bird and have learned about keeping others. I'm just...
This article,
though. It seems like every time I hear about the California... It's like, California condors have evolved So that they can only eat methamphetamines. And so now we have to create...
Well, you're also using some of the things that I've told you to kind of color that opinion. But this is essentially talking about how now the puppet masters who...
Oh, here we go. Here we go. It's all about the New World Order. Everybody get your tinfoil hats on.
No. The people who are feeding
the condors. A Walmart truck tipped over, and there are a bunch of signs in the back talking about martial law.
No, they're seriously studying, like, thousands of hours. If you're going to be a condor puppet, if you're going to be somebody who's feeding the food to the baby condors.
Oh, boy, is that one of our jobs in our job?
There's an actual job out there.
Yeah, I'm sure.
There are jobs... Their jobs to dress up as whooping cranes. And that's like an educational thing, is you get to dress up.
I know. I've seen the pictures of the people who dress up like pandas so that they can pick up the panda cubs.
At the end of the day, the panda costumes are terrifying. They look like the sheep at the state fair and the KKK costumes. And they're not KKK costumes. They're actually
to keep the lambs warm after they've been shaved.
Sheared, yes.
Oh, excuse me. Sorry.
But that's kind of what the panda costumes look like.
Yeah.
But, so, now if you're going to operate an adult condor puppet to feed a baby condor, you have to watch all this stuff. And so they've had to learn things like, one of the key things that have been missing from the condor relationship with the puppet is abuse. So when the condor chick does something that is non-condor-like or kind of starts...
Right.
They have to slap it around a little bit.
Okay, so I have a question. Are they suggesting that the condors beat up this guy's mattress because they thought the mattress was a puppet?
No. They're just saying you need to be assertive and aggressive because just being the cute puppet head...
Or
feeding...
are they... suggesting that at one point mattresses roamed the plains of America in California.
You need to let the mattress go right now. The mattress is no longer part of this conversation. That was just the story opener.
Right.
And that was intriguing to me because I remember that poor guy being vilified for, like, how dare this guy be upset that a bunch of endangered species were ripping
up. I have an actual question for you. Okay. What do California condors eat?
Dead stuff. They're like turkey vultures.
Okay, are there no turkey vultures in California?
Oh, there's tons.
Okay, so is there some ecological niche that is not being serviced by the, or that it's only being serviced by the California condor?
No. As a matter of fact, we have to put food out for the condors.
Okay.
Here's where it gets even more complicated.
Yeah.
They eat a lot of lead.
Yeah.
And so there are some people out there who are very upset that they have had to manage land according to the government. The government and the UN helicopters, you know. So there's even carcasses that are laid out for condors that are laced with lead fragments in there. So that's one of the big things is that these trying to keep them, there's plenty of carcasses. They're trying to get them to only eat carcasses that don't have lead. And then you have people that are putting carcasses out there that are full of lead. The California condor is a cluster of fudge. But no, I just thought this article was interesting. That is, if you're going to, you can no longer just raise birds with a puppet and expect them. And okay, here's something else that's really fascinating, because this article also references the whooping crane thing, because there are whooping cranes now who have been raised in this puppet captivity situation.
Yep.
And I know people who have worked for the International Crane Foundation, fans of the International Crane Foundation, and there's been this big problem in Wisconsin because the adults are now to the point where they're raising, they're breeding in the wild and they're trying to nest. But all of a sudden, in the last few days of incubation, they're abandoning the nests. Now, the official story is that it's because of the black flies. The black flies are driving them off. And this story is saying, because they're being raised by puppets, are they missing some kind of essential thing that's like, no matter what happens, even in the last week of incubation, you get attacked by black flies. You sit and you incubate. It doesn't matter.
I don't know.
Well, I do know someone who had, I do know more than one person who has worked at the International. I do know one person who has worked in the puppet world with whooping cranes.
Okay, now, wait, okay. So, wait, this went from, you know, multiple people who work with cranes to, you know, one person who works with puppets. I know half a person who's watched The Muppet Show. I've had a person who's described Kermit the Frog described him. I know a person who likes cookies. This person really likes cookies.
Remember the
time? And I asked him about this.
Remember the time we met the woman who was originating one of the roles in Avenue Q?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
she came out in a bathrobe.
Oh, yeah. Jen, yeah.
I remember. Okay,
yeah,
I'm just trying not to identify her at this point.
Whatever.
Anyway, I'm just trying not to identify one of the many people
I know. Two Muppeteers by name that they would answer emails if I sent them to them.
Well, aren't you fancy?
I am fancy. I'm very proud of that.
Okay, well, I know some Birdeteers. Anyway, so,
are these the people who wear the hats that the birds fly onto and masturbate to?
I definitely know those people. And he's talking...
Now, are they doing this professionally?
You're talking about peregrine falcon hats. Let's be clear. Let's be clear that that was a breeding technique.
So, you hate people who wear vests, but you're friends with people who wear hats that peregrine falcons will masturbate to.
Let's set our cockatiel now.
Let's establish a baseline here, shall we?
I do.
I apologize to our listeners. We're redlining this already. Wow. Where were we? What were we talking about?
I was trying to say that I know someone
who has masturbated to a peregrine hat.
Now you took it to a bad place. This is why I didn't want to podcast tonight. Okay, no. I know people who work very hard. I know people with the crane. I don't know the Duggars. Are you ready for me to finish?
I'm more than ready.
Okay. So I know people who have worked with the International Crane Foundation, and I know people who've dealt with the whole puppet thing with the whooping cranes.
Sure.
One of them has said to me, even when you're in the whole whooping crane costume, and this is a full body costume, this isn't like the condor thing where it's just your hand in the condor head.
Now, is this something they do with the birds or something they do at conventions?
I wish they did it at conventions. No, at conventions. No, at conventions.
You hear it here first, folks.
No, actually, I saw them at a I've seen them at conventions more than once, and their shtick is, I'm going to tell you about the Crane Foundation. And then I need an audience volunteer to dress up as one of our cranes. Who's going to be that audience volunteer?
Oh, God.
It's not going to be me. But no, so like when the people who are actually authorized to dress up as a whooping crane.
So there's a certification process.
There has to be. This is scientific research. This is endangered species shit, man. I don't know if we can let this podcast go out on air.
Oh, okay. Continue.
So, this person who had done the whole puppetry with the whooping cranes thing.
Puppetry of the whooping crane. I've heard of this. It was on Broadway.
Keep it. Keep it there. That sometimes the chicks figured out who was who, no matter who was in costume. Right. So there was like subtle things that maybe the chicks were picking up on, like movement, breathing patterns,
okay, so
gait when you walk.
So what you're saying is whooping crane chicks could figure out the difference between an actual whooping crane and a human dressed as a whooping crane.
I'm not even saying that. I'm just saying they could tell individual humans under the costume based on gait, perhaps even tone of voice, things that we don't even notice that birds with their highly tuned sensibilities.
So the birds had crane dar.
They had human dar.
Yeah, that's.
They had guy dar.
All right, let's carry on.
So this is a really fascinating read over at Aeon.
Okay.
About the whole puppetry thing and why what hasn't worked. And it's interesting because there are little things that, you know, just from people that I know who've worked in these whole things and things that I knew about the condor things that have always just stuck in the back of my head. And things that I know about, you know, all the cluster fudges that have gone down with California condors when you see them out in the wild. and the problems that they've caused. And I was like, wow, this is a really fascinating article of what we've learned about raising birds with puppets and what hasn't worked, when quite a bit of it hasn't worked. Right. But it, I mean, really, it's kind of like the whole absentee parent thing. It's like, oh, wow, this is like being raised with an emotionally unavailable parent.
This has nothing to do with being a latchkey kid and coming home and watching Full House for 2 hours. This isn't, that's not right.
The final paragraph of this is awesome. A condor soaring over the Grand Canyon or the California Chaparral is no longer the, quote, soul of the wilderness, unquote. It is the manifestation of the passion, care, and effort of the people who work so hard to create the mere possibility of that moment. That's pretty much, because when you look at a condor now, it's like, you're not a symbol of the wild, because you are out there with a lot of subsidized care.
Look, I'm sure if I was sitting face to face with somebody who had worked so hard with these birds to keep them alive, I would be, because they've done more than I have ever done for wildlife. But it, me, but my separatism from this project, taking a step back, I'm not sure that this bird is meant to survive.
No, and I have been on board with the whole thing of, yeah, I don't know if the California condor, it's there are like, a lot of birds that you can look at now. It's like, would you be here without human intervention? Yeah. I think the purple martin is a great example of that. Mm. I mean, you look at it, it's like, they don't nest in old trees anymore with a ton of cavities carved out by a bunch of woodpeckers. Right. They're pretty much reliant on people putting up houses for them. And it's getting to the point where the people who are quote-unquote purple martin landlords based on these all these purple martin societies, they're saying things like, you should lower the house once a day and change the nesting material. That's not something martins would do in the wild.
No. All right. Do we have anything else?
Well, we need to talk about an article that really irritated the crap out of me in Audubon.
Okay.
So they had a post this week called Birds Through a Spotting Scope with the Audubon magazine.
Okay.
And it was essentially a woman, I think Carol Richards. And she was talking about how, and she's not a bird photographer, but she was talking about, and I think she's an artist, but she was talking about how birds through a spotting scope fascinated her, and she found them to be her own source of art. And it just, when I looked at the little paragraph and the photos, I got really incredibly angry. Because this is what happens when I teach digiscoping workshops. These are the sorts of photos that people get, and they tell me that they can't do digiscoping and how terrible it is. And I just had this visit, and I even like posted on Twitter and Facebook. I was like, really? Gee, thanks, National Audubon, for making what I do look stupid and just making it look like a joke. And they're like, no, that's not what happened. This is a woman who's an artist who posted her stuff. And then some people on Facebook were like saying, yeah, well, yeah, you should give them a lesson. And someone's like, well, you have really great equipment, or you always strive to get the best photo. I have some artistic background.
All right.
What do you see with these?
No, continue. I will provide a commentary later.
Okay. Okay. So she chose to put vignetting in all these photos. That is a valid choice because it is something you can add into a lot of your photos with a lot of photo apps out there, including Instagram or Camera Plus or what's that other one? Snapseed. Putting a circle around your photo so it does look like you were looking through a spotting scope is popular. I'm arguing with some of the composition of the photos in this.
Is there a helicopter going overhead?
You have helicopters going over all the time. Have you never noticed we're on a medevac route?
No, okay. Sorry. Continue, please.
So the cardinal, for instance, that is not a good creatively composed photo. Sure. And I got really angry. And Audubon on Twitter was like, why don't you write an editor or a letter to the editor? And I was like, I really don't want to write for free. No, thank you.
Bazinga.
No, I just have a lot to do right now. And who reads letters to the editor?
Okay. First of all, I know you. Mm-hmm. And I know how you take digiscoping photos. And I know that you are trying to take the best, most... Now, are these photos actually from this woman? Do they... Mm-hmm. Okay, we have a quote. Okay. I know that you are trying to take the most photographically interesting and diagnostic photos of the bird. Because I have seen you looking at interesting birds and not take pictures of them because they're not in good light and they won't give you good photos.
Mm-hmm.
So if this woman is not a nature photographer and she is taking these pictures of the birds, she just may be taking... It's like this whole debate we had years ago about Instagram, back before you were using Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
And I was explaining, I was like showing you the filters. And it drove you crazy that people were putting vintage filters on their photographs.
I blogged about this, and this pissed me off so much because you went with me to go see that saw-whet owl in that right. Minneapolis backyard.
Yes. Oh, I know exactly what you're talking about.
And the post about. Is, I think it's even like Will Wheaton's Law or Don't Be a Dick, because there was a guy who was being a total dick while we were taking pictures.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm taking all these pictures to try and get the best color shots.
Yep.
And we posted them both to our social media accounts.
I took a photo of a saw-whet owl.
Yes.
Probably, I can't remember.
I think it wasn't Instagram, it was Hipstamatic.
It was Hipstamatic, and it made it brown and had grit on it and everything.
Yeah, yeah, it made it look like a photo, a craptastic photo.
It made it look like a photo from, like, 100 years ago.
Yeah, and everyone was like, that's the best photo of a saw-whet owl ever. And I posted a photo at the exact same time, which was tack sharp. And had, like, the actual color of the bird, and nobody cared.
Right. But what I'm saying, okay, so what I'm, but you have.
That house finch is not okay, Hipstamatic.
You have come around to, you use Instamatic filters.
When my photos are bad, it's like, well, I'll just put an Instagram filter on that and people will like it.
So this woman, who is not a nature photographer, has these photos and she's not trying to get a diagnostic photo. She probably looks at these photos and thinks about the emotion that the photo can conveys. Because, like, there's... Pan up a bit, because you just pan down. There's a photo of a cardinal, and the cardinal is kind of rousing, and it's got... First of all, her photos are very washed out. So she may like that kind of photo. There's one that's a silhouette of... Is that a...
Looks like a Steller's Jay.
A Steller's Jay. So it's... She's thinking more of the emotional content of these photos and what the tone conveys rather than here is what this bird looks like in real life.
Okay, I get that, like, of all the six photos that I'm looking at right now,
right.
I get that the Steller's Jay is like an emotional thing and it's it's a silhouette. She still could have taken that photo better with the equipment she had and got a more artistically pleasing photo of it.
According to you, but this is her vision of what these photos are. And it seems, I mean, I get what you're saying, but it seems slightly, I don't want to say, what's the word I'm looking for?
Elitist?
No, that's not the word. It's like she has her own vision that is different than yours. And she's not saying, here's how you take, you don't need to, she's not saying, taking great pictures of birds is crap. Here's how you really need to do it. She's saying, here's how you do this.
Okay.
According to me.
But looking
at... And you know what? She may not have given them her best pictures if she's an artist and was saving them for herself.
Here's the thing that's really driving me nuts.
Yeah.
These pictures are in a book.
Okay. What do you care?
I love that people have books.
Wow, taking a rather radical stance against the let's grab everyone's book and burn them in the plaza. Group. Boy, that's going to cost us a lot of listeners on our podcast here.
But it's even though...
We had a book called Disapproving Rabbits, let me remind you.
I know, that book should not have been a book. Yeah. So far, that's my best-selling book, although 1001s is catching up to it really quickly. Way more quickly than I thought. Because I always like saying that my rabbit book has always made more money than my bird books. But with the equipment that she has, and I'm not saying and I've linked to this, so if you want to follow along in the podcast, all you have to do is go to the blog post and look at these.
Well, who's to say she gave them her best pictures?
She felt she gave them her best pictures.
Did she say that in the article?
Well, she wasn't striving for tack-sharp focus. She was striving for interesting photos.
Okay, so how long has she been doing this? Maybe these are her first photos. Okay, let's go through and, like, look at some of the photos you took when you were first digiscoping.
Okay, this is why I wanted to bring this up, because I remember... And maybe I'm sensitive to this for several reasons. I remember when the blog was first going, and I remember when I went out with Stan Tekella and Brian Wheeler to take pictures of hawks. Actually, I just said that I was going out to Digiscope. I just wanted to sit next to these guys and watch them take pictures of hawks and learn all I can. And I remember there was like at one point a bird was landed and I started Digiscoping and taking pictures and standing by. I'm like, why are you taking pictures of that? It's terrible light. And I was like, it's not printable, but it's bloggable. I can build a story around this photo. So I am going to post this photo. And it was interesting to me. So even in my, I'm looking at this, I feel like with my lens of not having the best equipment, not that I have the best equipment now, although I have really nice equipment, but I'm looking at this through the lens of back when I had my Raven spotting scope and I'm taking pictures and trying to talk about things. I still feel like there were things she could have...
So you're saying there's no room for beginners in publishing digiscoping photos?
I'm saying there is definitely room for that. Should that be a book?
Okay, well, the thrust of this article is not, here's how to take the best pictures ever. It's, here's the emotional effect that I, as an artist, have of seeing birds and taking their pictures through a spotting scope.
Maybe I just don't dig this artist.
Maybe not, but I mean, I don't think that there's... you know, a problem with publishing a photo. Okay, this looks like a 600-word article. And so you're offended that pictures of this quality were published in Audubon, is what you're saying.
I think what I'm offended about, and actually now that you and I are working this out therapeutically on a podcast, I think
that I'm asking you why you're being such a dumbass about this?
I think what bothers me is that it was an Audubon magazine, and it was this whole thing that was showing up on Facebook and Twitter of, birds through a spotting scope. Here are the pictures. So it looks like an article about digiscoping. It's like, digiscoping can be so much more than that. And even for a beginner, I'm telling you, a lot of beginners out there with spotting scopes and iPhones, you can get much more artistically interesting.
Wow. Amazing.
Really?
Amazing. That's an amazing attitude to have. That's here's this article about this woman who was like, and maybe people will think, oh, here's this article. Wow, those photos, I could probably take photos like that.
I feel like these are the photos people take, and they're just like, I'm never going to do digiscoping ever again.
Not if they hear your podcast about this.
But I know that even if someone had like an iPhone, and let's say, I'm not even going to say a brand name, let's say you had a spotting scope that was under $1,000. You could, and if you understood things like photo composition, and I'm not even saying that you want to get realistic photos of the birds.
Continue.
That you could do a better job artistically. I may be digging maybe my problem is I'm not digging this. Maybe I'm like your mom when we were going through the Stein exhibit. Look, and she didn't get Picasso. And understand. I was like, that's totally okay. Not everybody gets Picasso.
These are okay photos of birds.
So artistically, you find these aesthetically pleasing?
The photo of the crow is very interesting.
That's a raven, not a crow.
Whatever! Okay, here's what Sharon's saying. Everybody who doesn't know everything about birds, stop watching birds right now.
I am definitely not saying that. I am not one of those people.
If you are a woman who is not as good as Sharon, stop publishing photos.
OMG. Do you know what can of worms you just opened? Of worms you just opened? Okay. I'm not saying if you're an upper echelon birder that you aren't going to get these photos. I cannot believe you just said what you just said. No. I just think even if you're someone who has a reasonably priced spotting scope and you have a point-and-shoot camera and you are just, like, taking pictures of birds because you enjoy them, I just want you to know you can take really good photos and you can take interesting photos and they don't have to look anything like mine and I'm still going to enjoy them. These photos, I'm trying really hard to look. I have seen beginner photos. A lot of beginners come to my digiscoping classes and people show me photos. Remember the bad photo contest that we had on my blog?
That I suggested, yes.
That was like one of the best photo contest idea ever. Yeah. There were more artistically pleasing photos in those. And I think maybe I'm just having a gut reaction to an artist that I don't care for.
What is so offensive about this? This person wrote an article about how much they enjoy taking photos of a bird through a spotting scope.
And it's not like they said...
So maybe I just need to let this go.
Go beat the birds to death with your spotting scope no! after you take their picture. I really don't understand what you're so upset about.
I think my issue was the way the headline showed up on Facebook.
Yeah.
With these photos. We're like, this is digiscoping, everybody! No, it's not.
It is! She took a photo through her spotting scope. That is digiscoping.
Oh, we are totally working out something therapeutically for me. You know where this is coming from? You know, I just suddenly figured it out where my ire with this is coming from. So in the last several months, I've done a lot of photography workshops.
Okay.
And I'm just saying that so that way we can obscure where this exact thing happened. Because you've heard this story.
Yep.
And so sometimes one of the workshops that I do, and I've been a part of this workshop on all sides. Sometimes you go to photography workshops where somebody takes captive birds.
Yeah.
From a bird of prey center. And they pose them and maybe they fly them around. And you can practice taking... It's not my preferred form of photography. But if you're someone who's trying to learn your equipment, it's a good way to try and figure out how to take pictures of birds of prey. And I had a really negative experience recently at one of these.
Okay.
Because it was a bunch of traditional photographers.
Right.
And they were not expecting digiscopers on this tour. And the guy that was, like, handing out guidebooks about all the birds that were going to be there was just kind of a jerk right off the bat. And he had been handing out all these books mm-hmm. that had information about, this is this species of bird we're going to see today. This is how it's going to behave. Maybe these are the photography settings you're going to want to use. Mm-hmm. And so as we're driving out to the place, he announces to everybody, oh, if you're a digiscoper on this tour, you need to give me back that book because that information is not going to pertain to you. And I kind of looked at him and I said, what do you mean? He was like, well, I don't want you to get any embarrassing questions from this book. And I said, what? There's like stuff in there about erectile dysfunction? What kind of embarrassing questions am I going to get? Because I am used to a lot of embarrassing questions. But it eventually, essentially what it came down to was the traditional photographer on this trip was poo-pooing digiscopers on this trip. And I was like, well, you're not real photographers. And I even said, wait, what? So maybe that's where my thing is coming from with this. Where I'm looking at this and I'm like, digiscoping can be so much more than this.
Yeah, that's the title of the article. Digiscoping is this and only this. This is as good as the photos are.
I think I'm just offended on several different levels when it says birds through a spotting scope.
Those are photos of birds through a spotting scope.
I've looked through a lot of different spotting scopes.
Okay. I've been like...
Birds look better than this.
Looking at these photos for the past 800 hours that we've been talking about this, and I cannot believe that we are talking about this and not most popular number three, crows understand the cause and effect.
What are you talking about?
Look at the sidebar, most popular number three.
One, two, three, crows... Oh, that's...
Now what are you more upset about?
The fact that they spelled cause, C-A-W-S-E. Oh, this is that thing we've already talked about. Yes. Anyway.
Audubon Magazine.
Maybe I should just say at this point, you should subscribe to Audubon Magazine. They can argue about it as long as we have. Audubon, I'm not going to write for you for free. Anyway, thank you for asking me to write a letter to the editor. Editor. Editor.
It's my favorite kind of tree is the editor.
So, well, since we're talking about nature.
Oh, boy. Oh, we're suddenly changing tack to talk about nature on this podcast. Hold on, everybody.
Since we're talking about nature photography, and since we're talking about Audubon, and since we're talking about all the things that offend me.
Oh, boy.
We've brought this up before about nature photographers, and I think in a very recent podcast we talked about recently about what is a nature photo, because there was a...
I do not remember that. Please continue.
Well, there was a photo that had to be disqualified because it was a really cool photo. And I think even King Kaufman himself was like, oh, this is a photo for your photo contest, Audubon, because this bird is perfect. Sure. It's great in its habitat. So they asked the photographer to send the original photo. Mm-hmm. And when they got the original photo and they compared it to the photo that he sent, it's like, oh, it's kind of stitched into another background. But the crazy thing is that it's stitched into the original. They took the left side of the photo and stitched it into the right side of a of the same photo in the habitat, but like, you know, they essentially just made the photo look a little nicer in the background, even though it was all... So they took, let's say they took 500 photos of this great horned owl in this habitat. Sure. They took one photo of the great horned owl in the habitat, and then they took another photo in, like... So they took photo one, and then maybe photo 200, and stitched them up, just to make it... Because... the way the lighting and everything played out, it looked better. As I'm
right.
So at the end of the day, it's like, it's this really great photo that you got ethically of a great horned owl, but you technically kind of stitched it together. So that's not just you taking one photo. It's stitching. It's a technicality when you look that they're just stitching in the background of the background that it was already in.
I get both sides of this, and I get why they have to be sticklers about this. I read an article a few months ago about like historical photos that had been altered, and there was one from Kent State, and it was this woman who was screaming and crying over the body of a fallen student. In the unaltered photo, the way the, and you have to remember Kent State, complete chaos, this photographer, you know, running, everybody's running around. In the photo, she is standing right in front of some sort of fence pole or something. So there is a fence pole coming out of her head.
Okay.
So when they published the photo, they took the fence pole out.
They had that technology back then?
Oh, yeah. You can totally... Yeah, they could doctor photos back then. You could doctor a negative. They didn't have Photoshop, but they could doctor a photo.
Okay.
And it just made, you know, it made the photo realistically better. But, I mean, there are, you know, there are... But there are also situations like there was a photo that came out of the Gulf War where the photographer had, there was some element that wasn't preferable. So he photoshopped it out and added in additional people from another photo. But I get why you have to be sticklers about things like that.
So Audubon has to be sticklers. And they've been like linking, they and I have a link to this article. They have a link to, you know, what constitutes... What is an allowable photo when, you know, you're doctoring photos? And another classic example is, I don't have it up right now, but you and I have talked about it before. It's the bald eagle going after the great blue heron.
Okay.
Have you seen that one?
I'm pretty sure I have.
It's so essentially, if you haven't seen it, and I have a link to it on the blog, there's a great blue heron flying. And a bald eagle.
They're matched up exactly.
They're matched up exactly. And the only thing that, like, trips you up, when, if you know birds at all, is you're looking at it, it's like, why doesn't the great blue heron have its legs sticking out behind it?
Right.
And if you know birds about how they fly at all, you're also looking at this and it's like, okay, this may have happened in an instant, but the way bald eagles and the, at this point in the photo, if a bald eagle were this close to a great blue heron that it was chasing, its talons would be
It looks like something you would see in a field guide if you were, for whatever reason,
for identification purposes, not as a realistic behavior.
Yeah,
because
no, that's not how,
But if you just look at it on its own, you're like, oh, that's a compelling photo. That's really interesting. But if you're someone who knows birds, you're like, why does the heron not have any legs? And why is
the heron wouldn't have its head tucked in like
the heron? Well, the heron would have its head totally tucked in. It wouldn't have it halfway sticking out like it is there. That's the relaxed heron fly. Herons will sometimes fly with their head out like that. And it was disqualified from some photo contests. But that's an example. And another recent example, which I've linked to in the blog, and I brought it up so you can I can talk about it.
Sure.
There was a green heron photo that won some kind of obscure photo prize with, like, the Ozark roadway system with the national park. And it was making the rounds on the internet, and I was looking at it, and was like, that is a well-processed image. And the woman's like, no, I didn't photo process this at all. I just happened to catch the right moment. And I'm looking at this, and I'm trying to figure out in my head...
What kind of bird is it?
Well, I know it's a green heron.
It's a green heron who is it drinking or is it dipping for fish?
If you look, there's it's got a fish in its mouth.
Okay, it's hunting for a fish, but it's got its wings out of it as if it's displaying.
So, well, there are some species of heron that will put their wings out to kind of create a shade so they can hunt fish.
Okay.
You know, you remember that BBC thing we saw where it was like nighttime, daytime.
Whatever.
And some people have said, well, clearly the heron has its wings out, so that way it's balancing itself on this branch. So, but it's like, of all the bazillion times that I've, and a green heron is a very common bird
right.
that we see here, and I've seen it in a lot of states. It's like, the wings look wrong,
mm-hmm.
the feathers look wrong. I think this is a photoshopped image for several reasons. I'm okay. not saying it's not a compelling image. It's a really cool image. When you look at it, you can't help but look at it because it's beautiful the way the light is and mm-hmm. the color composition. But just as someone who watches birds out in the wild, it's like, did they take bald eagle wings and stick that on a green heron and then just color it in so it looks right. like you green heron wings?
You need to see the digital.
I would never seen a green heron yeah. with its wings out like that while it's grabbing a fish. And then someone said, well, yeah. maybe it's trying to balance itself. But then it's like, yeah. I'm looking at the log that it's perched on.
If I was the editor awarding the, I'd want to see the digital, the original image, because what we're looking at is very small here.
And also, if you look at it, it looks clearly like the wings have been put on. So yeah. there's this whole big thing, and this is one of the things that I'm wondering, because I've talked to photographers who years ago would enter in art festivals with their wildlife photography, and artists would walk by and like, why do you think you're an artist here with your wildlife photography? And it's like, you can have really great color composition and really great the way the birds are set up in the photo and have it be art. You just cannot have it be vignetted and blurry and then I'm going to argue about it when it's an Audubon magazine.
Exactly.
I completely realize this. And this is why I wanted to do the podcast this way, because it's like, I'm trying to work out my therapy and my art issues here. Because my favorite things right now are bird artists who do really crazy shit. I love Rob McBroom, who does the modernist take on ducks in the duck stamp contest. He's never going to win, but his duck stamp stuff is the most intriguing artwork.
I think you're falling into a very common artist trap versus this is what I could do and this is what I could do better. Or this is what I could not do, and this is what I could do better. Which is the common complaint that you hear when people are looking at modern art. It's like, oh, my kid could do this better than... You're looking at the skill and not at the...
So is that what I'm doing when I like look at Rob McBroom and Tony Fitzpatrick, who are bird artists? Who mm-hmm. Or Catherine Hamilton.
Right.
Three of my favorite bird artists. And I look at their stuff and I'm like, this is really... And they're not doing photography. They're doing actual bird artwork. No, I mean,
we've talked about this before. Back when you had, you know, like 5 years ago, you would take these photos and I would think they were absolutely amazing. And you would say, oh no, there's chromatic aberration around the edge of the wing here that, you know, is like a purple pixel that wasn't supposed to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you're looking at a technical level and not the emotional impact that it has for the particular person.
I don't know if any picture I've digiscoped has had an emotional impact on anybody except me. Maybe you.
Who knows?
My stuff is not Rob McBroom. My stuff is not Julie Sycophus. My stuff is not Tony Fitzpatrick or Catherine Hamilton. But that's because
we're running really long.
That's fine.
But you look at things scientifically. You are trying to... I mean, we've talked about this with many... of the books that have come out that aren't for hardcore birders, that are pictures of birds, and you're like, oh, this isn't that amazing. It's like you're trying to take the most diagnostic picture of a bird.
Mm-hmm. That's what I'm trying to do, but, you know, So last week I had to do a segment for Minnesota Public Radio's All Things Considered. Minnesota Public Radio's mm-hmm. All Things Considered.
Right.
We have an Audubon exhibit going on at the Bell Museum of Natural History through June here in the Twin Cities. So if you're in the Twin Cities, you should go there.
Okay.
And I normally do, you know, hey, what's going on bird-wise on All Things Considered? And the host was like, hey, there's an Audubon exhibit at the Bell Museum. Sharon, do you want to go?
Right.
It took me a good hour to reply to that, because my initial response was, I really don't want to go look at Audubon things.
Right.
I really don't want to go at all. Because they're non-realistic.
It's non-realistic. He is extremely important historically.
But then I thought...
But it's non-realistic. Because
yes.
He did not... Because, I mean, has... Well, that's the odd thing that we discovered, is that he was praised for posing his birds naturalistically. Which makes you... Because we went to... The Minnesota Institute of the Arts.
Yes.
And saw, like, what was it? They had an exhibit
Lady
about...
Lady Empries.
Birds of India or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, she hired all those Indian
and
artists.
And all these... And, like, so they talked about, like, these photos, which I thought they were very well, I mean, you like praised one of them as like being extremely detailed, but it was like, but when Audubon came along, he posed the birds naturalistically, and you were like,
no, but Audubon didn't. Audubon got so much haterade in his day. If Audubon were alive today, he would be a super popular blogger and TV host, and he would be hated by everybody. But what I'm
saying is, it's in terms of science and in terms of depiction of nature, it's step by step.
But anyway, so I was really nervous about doing this. So at the end of the day, I was like, okay, yes, I'm willing to do this. And so I grabbed every single Audubon and Alexander Wilson biography that we had in our home. And we actually have an Alexander Wilson, which we've talked about. You found in our laundry room.
I told you about, yeah.
Yeah, you were like, hey, there's a brown bird painting downstairs you want to go look at in the laundry room. Because when people move out, they leave things in the laundry room that are free. And I went down there and I glanced at it. I was like, oh, it kind of looks like an Audubon. And then I was like, wait a minute, that's not an Audubon. And then I grabbed it and I thought, what has happened here is that some guy is moving to his girlfriend / fiance's home. And she said, home. Oh. And she said, the ugly brown bird painting is not coming into our new home. And I looked at it, and I was like, this looks familiar. And I was like, oh, it's an Alexander Wilson. So anyway, so I was super nervous about doing this. I get to the Bell Museum that's doing the exhibit through June to wait for NPR. The curator of the exhibit for the Audubon elephant illustrations that are out there is like, yeah, they asked me to be part of this too. And I'm like, now I'm super nervous because I know what I want to say about Audubon, but the curator of the exhibit who knows all the ins and out of art history, and I feel like I know just the peripheral stuff, is here. I'm just like, and I took the Wilson with me, and I told him, I said, I feel like we can't talk about Audubon without talking about Wilson, and I brought a Wilson that I found in my basement, and he said, oh, you think this is a Wilson? Let me take a look at it. And I was like, yeah, I'm pretty sure it's a Wilson. And he's looking at it. He's like, oh, this is a Wilson. You need to get this reframed ASAP because there's some acid problems with this. And he's showing me things that are wrong with it. So we need to get this reframed. And I said, yeah. And I said, I think this is a Wilson that's been done posthumously because of, you know, just, and he's like, no. I think this is the act. So they actually have an actual Wilson, one of his books. And if you have not read the whole thing about Wilson and Audubon, Wilson was a Scottish ornithologist who was trying to document as many birds as possible in a book. And he met up with Audubon at a store in Louisville, Kentucky. He actually met a French dude in Louisville, Kentucky, because he was trying to sell subscriptions to his bird book. And this French dude in Louisville, Kentucky started to buy it. And then his friends were like, oh, my friend, your illustrations of the birds of North America are way better than this Alexander Wilson. You should not buy a subscription. And that was when Wilson and Audubon met. Because Audubon was French. So you pretty much the birthplace of ornithology in North America between a Scots guy and a French guy.
All
right. But anyway, where am I going with this?
I have no idea.
Oh, so I ended up talking about birds and art and why Audubon, some of his stuff, so Wilson is like killing stuff and trying to shoot it in a scientific way and document it in a scientific accurate way.
Right.
And Audubon looks at Wilson's stuff and is like, my stuff is way better because I'm trying to draw out life size and I'm trying to give it life. So Audubon goes out and tries to do all this stuff. But he realizes when he gets things like great egrets and great blue herons, I can draw you life size, but your body doesn't fit into what I'm trying to do. So I'm going to give you this kind of crazy posture just to make sure you look life size. So Audubon stuff has a lot of life and verve if it's not accurate.
Sure.
And then they had his stuff compared to Julie Sycophus. They even had an original.
She was alive at the time?
No. The great thing about the Bell Museum exhibit was they had all the Audubon stuff in there, and they had the stuff that influenced Audubon, like Wilson. They had people who came after him, like Fuertes, and then they had, you know, modern day people like Julie Sycophus and David Sibley. They even had a Charlie Harper there to just talk about how Audubon was an influence and how people can still try and capture the movement and passion and the vitality of birds today. But they all do it in such different ways. I was so excited because they were like, because Tom Crane from Minnesota Public Radio was like, we're going to talk about Audubon and we don't have a lot of time, but pick one artist in here after Audubon that you want to talk about. And it's like, there's so many artists to choose from. So I chose Julie Sicafoos.
Of course.
Well, I love Julie Sicafoos.
All right.
Let's just end this podcast because I have absolutely nothing else to say.
We're at an hour and 9 minutes.
I'm sorry. I'm really sorry. I don't know if you're going to get another podcast after this because between the web series and my travel schedule, and you're even traveling with me on some of this, we're just not going to be able to do the podcast probably until June. And if the podcast is what you love, please watch Digiscoping with Clay and Chaz on the Bird Chick YouTube channel. You'll probably win something. We have a lot of things we're giving away.
Okay, I'm going to wrap this up now.
Please, I'm just
going to
sit
interrupt
here.
Me with another story.
I'm not gonna.
All right, this is Bird Chick Podcast number 168. If you have any questions about the stories we've talked about, go to birdchick.com, click on the blog. You'll find the links there. If you have any questions for Sharon, you can talk to her on Twitter where she is at birdchick, or email her where she is sharon@birdchick.com.
I love you.
She hasn't thought of anything to say. We'll talk
to you
later.
I really love you. I love you so much.
Bye-bye.